Good morning. In the matter of State versus Thomas Outland, can we please have appearances of counsel?
Michael Denny, Assistant Deputy Public Defender, on behalf of Thomas Outland.
Good morning, Your Honors. Assistant Prosecutor Michelle Buckley from Union County on behalf of the state.
Welcome, counsel, and thank everyone for using the mute button when they're not speaking. Mr. Denny, please go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'd like to reserve a few minutes to respond to the state if necessary.
That's fine.
The right to self-representation exists to affirm the dignity and autonomy of the accused and to protect the capacity of criminal defendants to make choices for themselves. This constitutional right arises from a profound respect for the individual as the lifeblood of the law. As long as defendants have an understanding of the difficulties associated with self-representation and make a knowing and intelligent waiver of their right to counsel, their choice to exercise this right should be respected. However, when trial courts misapply the law and require specialized legal knowledge, training, and the experience of a criminal defense attorney, the right to proceed pro se no longer exists. The examination of the trial court in this case was deficient for this exact reason. The court focused overwhelmingly on legal concepts and denied the request because Mr. Outland was not going to present his case as well as his licensed attorney would have. This was a structural error, and as the Supreme Court has said, the right to self-representation is either respected or denied. Its deprivation cannot be harmless. This decision completely eclipsed the reasons Mr. Outland had for wanting to exercise his right. He felt that he knew everything there was to know about his case because he was there when the incident took place and felt as though he were the best person to represent himself. He'd been through the justice system many times before and knew what counsel would and would not be able to do for him, and also the pitfalls of proceeding without a lawyer. His choice to exercise his constitutional right was personal and should have been respected. And he made the further choice to petition this court, pro se, a petition that was granted, and to file a supplemental pro se brief. Here he stands, qualified to bring a legal issue before the highest court in the state, and yet somehow unable to make a knowing and intelligent waiver of his right to counsel below, despite having an understanding of the criminal process, his defense, and having requested standby counsel to aid him when needed. The decisions of the trial court and of the appellate division denying Mr. Outland the opportunity to exercise his right are mistaken and must be reversed. This concludes my opening statement. This court should affirm its longstanding jurisprudence that legal knowledge, as such, is not relevant to the question of a knowing and voluntary waiver of the right to counsel. If it were, nearly every defendant seeking to go pro se would be disqualified for one reason or another, likely also many lawyers and judges. For example, here the trial court asked Mr. Outland how many peremptory challenges he was entitled to, a question the judge was unsure of the answer to and had to double check with the prosecutor. It was the same thing with Mr. Outland's sentencing exposure. The judge originally told him he was subject to up to 20 years and was later corrected by the state when they brought up his priors and the possibility of a life sentence. My point being here that these questions aren't easy for lawyers to answer, nor for judges, and certainly not for lay people untrained in the law. They're also not the type of questions that probe whether someone knows how a lawyer will be able to help them for them if they choose to forego that help, which is the real focus of the waiver. Unfortunately, these types of open-ended questions were the only ones the trial court asked, and they failed to comply with Crisafi, which requires the court to inform the defendant of the charges, the defenses, and the sentencing exposure. Instead, Mr. Outland got quizzed over each. The judge asked him, "What are the elements of conspiracy to commit robbery? What are your statutory defenses? And what's your understanding about the punishments that you're exposed to?" These types of questions evoke right or wrong answers, but they don't give the defendant the information he needs to make the waiver. And for most defendants, like was true here for Mr. Outland, it might not even be clear that the questions are about concepts that apply in the case. On page 14, line 22, the court asked, "Do you know what an admission by a party opponent is?" "Admission by a party opponent? Yes." "Do you know what that is legally?" "No, I can't say that I do." "Would that have anything to do with my guilt?" These questions are simply uninformative, and they don't really give the trial judge any way to judge whether or not Mr. Outland is making the type of waiver required. Doing a quiz and then denying the waiver when the defendant fails the quiz is not what Crisafi requires, and it's hard to see how not knowing a piece of information before the court has provided it means that after it's given, someone can't make a knowing and intelligent waiver. On the one hand, the court's required to inform the defendant of his situation that he's in and the rights that he's relinquishing, while on the other hand, the defendant has to acknowledge those rights and understand them, but that's all that's required to make the waiver. And a further point concerning open-ended questions, the court did ask one that really probed Mr. Outland's understanding. On page 15, line 1525, the court asked, "Tell me in your own words, sir, what you believe the technical problems are associated with your acting in." To which Mr. Outland responded, "If I'm not planning on taking the stand, so I have to stay within the statements made by the witnesses and within everything that's in my, I can't add to it. I can't say anything anyone else said," which indicates that Mr. Outland knows that he can't just stand up in front of the jury and give a narrative. And he knows that the evidence is the thing that comes from the witness's testimony. And he knows that he's going to have a hard time separating the two, which I think really does show that he understands the situation that he's in, and he was able to make a knowing and intelligent waiver. Just briefly about the appellate division decision, they were right to acknowledge that the colloquy was overly technical, but wrong in their conclusion about waiver, largely for the same reason as the trial court. It wasn't Mr. Outland's fault that he didn't know all the charges or the sentencing prior to the hearing, and it's not his fault that the trial court failed to do its job and to advise him during the hearing. Had he been properly told, and absent evidence that he was mentally ill, intoxicated, or otherwise incompetent, if that he understood the information, then he would have made a valid waiver. Therefore, because the examination of Mr. Outland's waiver was insufficient, the appellate division's opinion should be overturned and the case remanded for a new trial, one in which, should he so choose, he can exercise his Sixth Amendment right to represent himself.
Questions, anyone? Thank you, Mr. Denny. Ms. Buckley. You have to unmute yourself, please.
Sorry about that. The Sixth Amendment of the United States Constitution and the New Jersey Constitution affords a defendant the right to counsel. It is one of the seminal rights of an individual charged with a crime and is carefully protected from the time a defendant is indicted to the completion of his case. The right is an acknowledgement that a layperson likely will not have the knowledge or skill to defend himself, particularly when the state will be represented by an attorney. While unquestionably a defendant can invoke his right to counsel in Ferretta v. California, the U.S. Supreme Court held that the defendant also has the right to waive counsel and represent himself. However, this, as with all other rights, is not absolute, and that a defendant must make a knowing and voluntary and intelligent waiver with a clear understanding of the consequences that may result. A defendant's decision must be made with his eyes open. A defendant's right to counsel. Accordingly, when a defendant seeks to represent himself, the trial court must conduct an inquiry to determine whether a defendant has, in fact, knowingly and intelligently waived his right to counsel. Importantly, in analyzing defendant's responses to this inquiry, the court should indulge every reasonable presumption against waiver. In this case, the trial court undertook such an inquiry and properly determined that defendant lacked a true understanding of the nature of his charges and his possible sentence. The trial court correctly denied defendant's motion to proceed pro se. In reviewing this decision, the appellate division similarly observed that defendant's waiver was not knowing and intelligently made. The court noted that although the trial court asked defendant technical questions, defendant's answers revealed not only a lack of understanding of the law, but also, and most importantly, a lack of understanding about his case, including the charges and his potential sentence. Because the trial court properly exercised its discretion in denying defendant's motion to represent himself, the decision of the appellate division affirming the trial court's order should be affirmed by this court. And that also concludes my opening statement.
Ms. Buckley, take away the defendant's lack of knowledge on a host of different areas. Did the trial court inform the defendant of the nine areas that Crisafi and Reddish, and more recently in Dubois, the court required defendants be informed of?
Your Honor, in reviewing the transcript, the court did address nearly all of those factors that are outlined in Crisafi and Reddish, and then subsequently in Dubois. Though it was not in the same order that is outlined in Crisafi, the trial court did address many of those instances. But more importantly, what the trial court did was conduct an open-ended colloquy with the defendant addressing those issues to determine whether or not the defendant had an understanding of his waiver, whether this was something that he was doing intelligently, specifically by knowing all of the facts related to his specific case. So while it may not have been entirely complete in its addressing of all of the factors outlined, all of the requirements outlined in those cases, it was a thorough examination of the defendant and his understanding of what he was doing.
So I think the inquiry showed that it was quite likely not a good decision for the defendant to seek to waive. But did the colloquy demonstrate the defendant's understanding of the consequences of the waiver? Did it gauge that, which is at the heart of the court's case law?
I don't think that it did. I don't think that it. I'm sorry if I don't know if I'm exactly answering your question, but the colloquy did determine whether or not this defendant had an understanding of the waiver. And that was what was necessary. And the trial court did inform the defendant of all of the charges that were against him. So I do think that the colloquy addressed the meat of the issue, which was whether or not this defendant was making a knowing and intelligent waiver. And this was arrived upon by the court in the negative, in determining that this defendant didn't, at the 3 days before trial, didn't even understand or know what he was being charged with, specifically that he was charged with a conspiracy to commit robbery, as well as the fact that he didn't understand the complete sentencing exposure that he faced. This defendant was unaware that he actually had 3 robbery convictions. He thought he only had 2. He was unaware that he was mandatory extended term eligible. The court did advise him of that. And even then, during that portion of the colloquy, when he learned that he was actually mandatory life eligible, the defendant still was not quite getting that it wasn't just going to be an additional 20 years on top of the sentence he was already sentenced, he was already serving, but that it could be life on top of the to run consecutive to
Ms. Buckley, the colloquy reads in part like a bar examination, and I thought that our Crisafi-Reddish jurisprudence required the judge to advise the defendant of his rights, the charges, that proceeding pro se is probably not in your best interest. And when all those things are done with eyes open, though it may not be and it probably won't be in his best interest to proceed on his own, he still has the right to do that. That's one of his rights, the right to represent himself. That's a fundamental right. Am I mistaken in terms of my characterization of what happened here?
I don't think that you're mistaken with regard to your characterization of the colloquy as being technical, but I do think that the trial court made an attempt to narrow those technical questions as it pertained to this defendant's actual case, to the facts of his case, to the evidence that would be introduced against him, and his understanding.
But our case law, and this goes back to Feretta, I believe, begins with the premise that a pro se defendant is not going to be conversant with the rules of evidence or the substantive criminal law. He's got to be advised of, you know, you're proceeding on very thin ice because you don't know this, you don't know that. These are your charges. And I think it comes down to, do you understand what you're giving up? Do you understand that this may not be in your best interest? And so provided that the defendant says, yes, I understand all of that, he or she is permitted to represent him or herself. Am I mistaken about that?
I agree with you to the extent that the court should, in accordance with the case law, the court should advise the defendant of all of those things, that this is an unwise decision, that these are the charges against you and these are the consequences. However, our courts have steadfastly guarded defendants' right to waive a, safeguarded a defendant's waiver of rights when he was not completely informed of the facts surrounding that waiver. For example, in AGD and State v. AGD and State v. and subsequently in State v. Vicente, this court found that a defendant could not knowingly waive his right to remain silent or right to counsel if he did not know all of the circumstances, if he was not aware of the fact that he was being that he had already been charged, and that he couldn't make an intelligent decision without knowing that critical piece of information. Similarly, in State v. Bellamy, this court found that a defendant couldn't knowingly waive his right to a jury trial, couldn't plead guilty.
But that's the court's obligation. So if he didn't, so the judge told him, "You're charged with conspiracy." Apparently, everyone got wrong the fact that he was charged with first degree conspiracy because that didn't even exist. It's only second degree. The court and all the counsel seem to get that wrong. But after he advises the court, that's the role of the court and counsel. These are your rights. These are the facts. These are your charges. Do you still want to go ahead? Because it's against your best, because it's not going to probably be in your best interest. And he says, yes. Is any more required?
I do think that it's required that that a defendant be able to have a complete understanding of what that means. To simply just recite what the charges are, what the sentence is, I don't think gets to the meat of the actual waiver, which is an understanding of what's at stake, an understanding
I was shorthanding it. The chief told you the nine categories. I'm just talking about the Crisafi Reddish categories. Those have to be read, explained to defendant, and then once he evidences an understanding of that, then he's permitted to exercise his fundamental right to represent himself. Am I off about that?
What I would say in response to that, Your Honor, is that to simply just have a trial court read off and engage in that type of discussion, so long as the defendant understands that what he's doing is not, that the technical difficulties that he will face, is basically issuing a rubber stamp, that if a defendant merely says, I want to represent myself and I know these charges and I know what I'm up against, that basically removes the discretion of the trial court, who has the opportunity to view the defendant, to see what, his demeanor, his presence in the courtroom, and whether he actually has an understanding of what he is, what the right that he is waiving. And in this case, even in the trial court's decision, he does note, I've watched the defendant. He's very defensive. I don't think he has an understanding of what he's waiving. And that was within the discretion of the trial court to make that decision, to simply go and have a trial.
Isn't there a difference between ensuring that the defendant has an understanding of what he's waiving and doing what this trial judge did, which was quizzing him and essentially holding him to the standard of a lawyer? I mean, the judge even says at one point, of course any lawyer would know something with regard to the rules of evidence. I mean, this was like an exam. I don't think that's what Crisafi says should be done. The judge is supposed to inform the defendant of all of these things, but he was quizzing him about all of these factors. I mean, isn't that right? He wasn't informing him what his charge was and his exposure. He was quizzing him. He wasn't informing him with regard to the technical difficulties. He was quizzing him with regard to what he thought, with regard to what the defendant knew about different rules of evidence and rules of court and things that, you know, like the public defender noted, not even the parties in the courtroom got correct. So, I mean, there's a difference between what happened here and what the case law indicates is supposed to happen. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, I would agree that the questions were technical. However, they were technical as they pertained to this specific case. And I believe that in reading the transcript, what comes through is that when the court was asking those technical questions, what happened was it was in an effort to demonstrate that this is going to be an incredibly difficult task for you. So yes, there were questions that were technical with regard to the court rules, with regard to evidence, admissions by a party opponent. All of those things were an attempt by the court to demonstrate how difficult this was going to be. Similarly, the court then pointed to defendant's counsel at the time to indicate, to go over what counsel's credentials were and how long he had been practicing, to basically draw a distinction between, the defendant's experience and knowledge as opposed to counsel's experience and knowledge. So,
Counsel is an attorney. So under that type of colloquy, no defendant, even some practicing attorneys, would be able to represent themselves, would be able to go pro se.
Well, the distinction that I would draw would be that the way that the transcript reads is that it's an effort by the trial court to demonstrate to the defendant how difficult the task would be, which would be in as it's directed in Crisafi and Reddish, that it should be made known to the defendant how difficult, what kind of technical difficulties he is going to be facing as he moves forward.
And there's no doubt that the judge was doing it in good faith and did that part of it well. I mean, there's no doubt about that. Nobody here, in some sense, he's trying to protect this defendant, for want of a better term, from himself. He's trying to, but unfortunately, that's not really what the issue is. Once he advised him of all that, did it well, asked him all these questions to make him understand, as he clearly must have, it seems, how difficult this was going to be, he still said, with his eyes open, the defendant knowingly and apparently intelligently, sounded like it, in light of his rationale, I want to represent myself. I'll take standby counsel, but I want to represent myself. So I get all you're saying. I don't think anybody has a dispute with anything you're saying, anything the judge did, tried to do, his intentions, his hopes, but that's really not why we're here. We're here because, notwithstanding all that, apparently the defendant said, I still want to represent myself. That doesn't sound like a question. I guess that sounded like a statement, but that's really what we're here considering. All your representations make sense, and everything the judge said makes sense and are taken in the best possible light. Problem is, how do we deal with the fact that after all that information that you've described, everything now that he's made the defendant aware of correctly and appropriately, he said, I still want to represent myself. What do you do about that?
Well, I think what's important to note in this case, as I've said before, is that this defendant didn't have an accurate understanding of his own case. And I think that that's an important factor that needs to be considered more than just advising a defendant of what the charges are that he faces, particularly when he wasn't, 3 days before trial was scheduled to go forward, he wasn't aware of one of the charges.
Ms. Buckley?
And I think that
Ms. Buckley, you've mentioned that twice now. Can you shed any light on the timing with respect to this motion? I understand that the defendant filed the motion at the end of November 2016, and this colloquy takes place several months later, February 10, 2017.
Correct. The defendant did file the motion in at the end of November. The court held this, heard this motion 3 days before trial was scheduled to begin. Defendant did appear with the counsel. This was his second attorney that he appeared with for trial for this motion. At the end of this motion, counsel was relieved because defendant did not want him representing him. And then new counsel was appointed by the public defender's office.
My question relates to the time from when the motion was filed until when it was heard. Can you shed any light on that length of time?
I don't know the reason why there was that 2 month period of time, approximately 2 to 2.5 months period of time that transpired between the filing of the motion and the time that it was heard.
Thank you. Other questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add, Ms. Buckley?
Nothing, Your Honor, just that it's the position of the state that the trial court did not improperly exercise his discretion and that the appellate division properly affirmed the trial court's order denying the defendant's application to represent himself pro se, and that this court should affirm the decision of the appellate division. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Denny, did you want to offer a rebuttal? You have to unmute.
No, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.